There are very unique parameters for the essays in this book. Can you explain to us what those are?
So the project began with an unusual kind of constraint, which is a total suppression of access to outside authority. In other words, I had the internet off, and I didn't review the books or films or other works that I consulted only in memory in these essays. And the essays are 24 single subject essays. They're very miscellaneous, like their author, on house sitting, on frittage, on foot washing, on dossiers, on Brer Rabbit. And so they are, in a way, sort of structuralist studies of the thing itself, how it functions, what it is, how it, you know, what its cultural significance is. But it's totally reliant on my own fallible, gap-filled knowledge. And so that's why the book ends with this long 22-page rolling endnote called Correction, in which fact after fact, I redress my errors.
How did that come to you?
You know, my first two books were poetry, and I was struggling at the time. This would have been 2008 or 9. And it was really a way to kind of kickstart the day into language, to have the internet off, to begin writing. But then it was also true that, you know, I was about 34, 35 then, and I had this sort of urge, maybe it was sort of like an early midlife crisis. I prefer the term reckoning, I guess. But I had this urge to say what I knew. And by that, I mean what I knew not only as a radio air quotes here, queer intellectual poet, but also as the son of a primitive Baptist and a truck driver, and also this professor without an office, an adjunct, who has been absorbed and expelled by academia many times over the years. And I wanted to sort of speak from all those subject positions. And so maybe it was a kind of integrative, a wish for integration at that point in my life.
And you called it specifically a reckoning. That's like the second subtitle of the book.
Right.
How did that come to you as a way of like dealing with this or grappling with the idea structure you'd set up?
Well, I grew up in central Piedmont, North Carolina, working class, Winston-Salem, Charlotte, just above the border in Virginia, and Patrick Springs and Stewart. And reckoning means a couple things to people who grew up fundamentalist Christian there. I mean, it's a word for best guess. It's a kind of counting up. My grandfather used to say he was reckoning when he was counting something. And also it's a Baptist and Protestant word for final judgment, you know, the judgment day, a reckoning with your past and with the truth.
Following the kind of question of reckoning, there are other books kind of similarly situated with this that I think that this book may talk to, like Maggie Nelson's books, which
yes.
She also references as reckonings. There are books by Claudia Rankine, Eileen Miles, and to a certain extent, Ta-Nehisi Coates's book, which are these personal essays that speak to much larger truths. Why do you think that this type of writing might be so important at the moment?
That's a good question. And, you know, I also want to say that A Reckoning, I think, is the subtitle of Maggie Nelson's The Art of Cruelty, a couple books back, which I loved. And so in a way, it sort of tethers me specifically to her work and her tradition. Why it's happening now is kind of a good question. I think there's something about poets in particular, like Claudia Rankine and Maggie Nelson, who are working in nonfiction, that is expanding the form. I mean, I don't know if I can answer why as much as speculate about what is happening. I mean, I think that in nonfiction and in essaying in particular, every 6 months it seems like capacity is expanded, that the genre is doing yet again something totally new. What I love about the writers you just mentioned is a kind of non-academic intellection, a free intellection, you know, the way Maggie Nelson, for instance, but you could also say Wayne Kestenbaum and Chris Krauss and other writers, are moving through received knowledge, but testing it all the time against their own personal empirical knowledge, their experience, stepstoning through what in a different kind of essaying would be discourse mounted on other discourse, mounted on other discourse. But instead, there's this real sort of independence right now in essaying that's new, but also harkens all the way back to Montaigne and Sir Thomas Browne and Gilbert White of Selborne, you know, 400, 500, 600 years ago.
This essay was written without correcting the facts during the initial parts of the writing.
Right.
How did that kind of test your reaction to the rest of the world? Like, did you find yourself at dinners, like, pushing away from Googling the answer to a question that someone may have on your phone? Or was there any reaction at all?
Well, it definitely was part of a kind of aversion to the way the internet can kind of follow you around, and you can be online in some sense 24 hours a day. And, you know, I think that it produces a different kind of writing, a different kind of hopefully reading experience than researched essaying does. There's something about trusting the culmination of the books you've read and the things you've seen and experienced, and your own life experience that, you know, is very personal. And I think that it's what I respond to in a lot of the writers I admire. There's a writer named Guy Davenport who was a classicist, but also a wonderful essayist and translator, who's from a town not too far from Charlotte, where I grew up, in Anderson, South Carolina. So there are a number of writers who have that kind of quality. I mean, actually, as it happens, Guy Davenport and Susan Sontag died the same week in 2003, at the end of 2003, I think. Wiki or Google can get the right answer there. But I remember thinking, you know, they're two of my favorite writers, and it seemed like a whole brand of independent essaying was dying out with them. I mean, they were two examples of people who really, by dint of their own willingness to point at the thing or the phenomenon or the book or the genre and say, by being present to this and being attentive to this, I can be expert in this. You know, untrained, just the quality of your mind and your attention. And that's something to aspire to, I think.
So given that kind of like aspirational interest and the parameters of the book, why did you actually come back at the end and do a tally or a fact check of your own error?
Because it was fun. It felt like something I had been saving for myself, you know? Like, so it's the complete reversal or inversion of the book's constraint. It was entirely wiki knowledge at the end. It's entirely factual. In fact, I try to keep it as brief as possible. And there's a little bit of, you know, stylistics happening there. But it's this, I think, sort of wonderful 99 item and growing. It's going to a second printing soon, and there's two more correctives that we've found for the endnote. But it's this great sort of non sequitur list in which I get to say what the real original purpose of the foyer was, or why minutes are really called minutes, the clerical record, who actually sang the song Tumbleweed, not Juice Newton, but Sylvia, the other crossover country artist in 1982. And many more. And they're just sort of fun to have next to one another. And really, I think it operates as a kind of 25th essay in the book, and also shows up the miscellany of my disparate coordinates. I mean, those things, Juice Newton and Philoctetes and the original purpose of the foyer, are weirdly sort of the coordinates of who I am.